listeners. I'm Logan McLean, and this is OJT, On the Job Training. It's a podcast where I, a journalism student, practice my craft by interviewing passionate people about their projects. Daniel Platts was here last spring to talk about his master's in anti-fascist action and decolonial ecology. Today features our talk about protests. Strange as it seems, the Wet'suwet'en crisis was a year ago. After a continued year of unrest, now seems a good time to release this episode about what strikes really do, why people stand in solidarity, and what it means to be an ally. Since moving to Toronto, you mentioned you went to just the one thing for Wet'suwet'en. I've seen pictures from a couple other things. What was the first kind of grassroots sort of involvement that you had in Toronto? First introduction to the scene there?
That was the September 27th climate strike. And that was like literally like I moved there in September, so it was right away, which was really nice. The turnout for it was amazing. Calling it grassroots almost feels like a misnomer because of how global that thing was and how many people were like behind it. Like it's like not just grassroots, it's tree roots at that point. But it was really nice. It was the first time I ever brought a musical instrument to a protest, which was the best ever because I could like do like little like strums to keep rhythm with chants and stuff. It was my mandolin too, which was like really fucking like, it's like a little bit interesting. It's not like, I don't know, it's easier to hold than a guitar. And like, I don't know, I just got to like bop around and it was gorgeous and sunny. And the age range of the protest was amazing to me. There were like families with kids there. There were dumb young adults like me. And then there was like 80-year-old people who were just like, yep, I'm sorry, but yep, we'll fight with you though.
Well, as you've surely noticed in the last couple of weeks, there's been some pretty exciting political goings on, specifically with the Coastal GasLink pipeline project. Mm-hmm. You went to a Wet'suwet'en solidarity action a couple days ago. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, like so honestly, I felt very guilty before going because this is an issue I care a ton about, and I had reading week recently, and that was coinciding exactly when the blockades were happening, exactly when the calls for solidarity were happening. And I missed like 5 different actions, and I felt so shitty because I'd find out about them like right after they happened, and I was like, "God damn it, dude! Where's your goddamn radical spirit?" So I found another one that was going to be happening on last Friday, I think. Either way, I found it, and I was like, "Holy shit! Okay, one that isn't from the past. Amazing! I'm going to it. I have to." We met at Queen's Park, which is right in the center of Toronto's downtown, and it's where the legislature is. It's also where the climate march happened, right? Good shit. Went there. When I showed up there were speakers. One especially moving speech was given by a woman who had been arrested by the RCMP in BC, and she had recently been released, and as far as I know, basically came straight there to talk. And she gave a very impassioned plea about kind of why we were all there. And one thing I think people don't necessarily understand about this movement is that it's not just about one pipeline. And it's not even just about the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs. It's much more about indigenous rights in general, specifically like the right to land. And it's about environmental destruction and a government that doesn't care about either thing. And that's that, like, I hear people say, oh, there's so many white people at this rally. And it's like, yes, it's a solidarity rally. It's for people who are going to show solidarity for this issue. You don't have to be indigenous to care about indigenous people, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one thing about this rally. It was, I think, like almost 2,000 strong, but the majority was white. It was led by indigenous people. There were singers there. There were drummers. It was like, and all the speakers were indigenous, and it was clearly like about that. But the bulk of the numbers was filled by just Toronto citizens. And of course it's a Toronto solidarity rally. So I don't know. I think people have too narrow of a scope when they conceptualize what this is about. I don't know. I hear a lot of critiques that are like, oh, what, do you want to like restore 5 chiefs that govern all of Canada or something like that? And you're like, no, It's not about establishing like some kind of new monarchy. It's about resisting injustice against people who have rights that have been infringed upon. But yeah, we met at Queen's Park, and there was like just lovely representation again, like a great age range, which I always love to see at a fucking protest, because it means the movement really resonates. And yeah, from there we started marching. We marched down University Ave, and we had it filled from about College to Elm, which is a considerable distance, just to like get a sense of like the size. Obviously not the biggest rally that's ever happened in Toronto. It's fucking Toronto, but like it was much stronger than I anticipated. I was worried that like, because it was at the end of the week and like there'd already been so many actions before, that people would kind of be burnt out and there wouldn't be a good turnout, but it was quite substantial. We marched all the way to Nathan Phillips Square, which is, I don't know if you've ever seen the big like sign with the Toronto letters. That's where that is. And we did a round dance there, which was like honestly one of the most amazing like protest experiences I've ever had. Not least of all because it forced strangers to hold hands. Like I think that in and of itself is valuable. Like there's one thing to be said for kind of chanting beside people, but like having actual contact and then dancing together in this continuous circle. Like I think the round dance got to about 5 concentric rings of people all just like swirling to this drum beat in the center. And yeah, it felt very powerful, and it felt very different from the kind of activity that happened at the climate strike. The climate strike felt very much like an aesthetic maneuver of just people going, haha, here's my sign. It's a funny joke about Trudeau. Huh? It's great. And you're like, yeah, that's sick. I'll take a photo. Ah, blah, 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 blah. Oh, we'll chant. Oh, whose streets? Our streets. Woohoo. Right. But then just like it gets a decent amount of media coverage and everyone goes home. Whereas this very much was about cultural resurgence. That's what it felt like. It was the first people of this land in a defiant act just saying, no, we are here. We refuse to be moved. We have an obligation to respect this land, and you've infringed upon it. So it's our duty to resist and to restore this sacred relation of justice and harmony. And one thing that really struck me about the protest was that it was scheduled to go from 12 to 3, right? The climate strike, similar kind of thing. It ended basically on time, the climate strike. This one, the round dance started at 3, which was good. And I assume that's what they meant. But then the songs just kept coming. And I started to get the sense that they weren't ever going to stop. Like, I even, like, thought, wait a minute, is the plan to just, like, set up a blockade in Nathan Phillips Square? Because, wow, that would be amazing. But, like, slowly over time, by about 4, the majority of people had left. But, like, the songs kept going. And I stuck around till about 4:30, but I hadn't eaten all day. And I had a paper proposal to work on. And it was hard to leave, though. It was, yeah, like, man. I did something that made me feel incredibly guilty at this protest, just to like full honesty here.
Let's hear it.
I smoked a joint and I realized this was a terrible fucking idea after. And it was around like 4, almost, probably close to 4:20 actually, before I left. And it was just like down to maybe like 30 people just in a circle around this drum. And I kind of stepped back a bit because I didn't want to just like be smoking weed in people's faces. That'd be horrible. But for better or worse, I put like a lot of sacred significance in weed. And I don't know. I find it makes situations reveal themselves differently. And I was curious what this very intimate moment would feel like. I stepped back, I smoked my joint, and thankfully there was like a lot of wind, so it wasn't like the smell wasn't persisting. But I realized the weed instantly hit my revolutionary spirit, and it made me think more about how hungry I was. It made me more like realize how tired my legs were. It made me go, oh, damn. Like, whoa, I kind of feel like slightly anxious now. Well, what am I supposed to be doing? What's my role here? Whoa, which are like valid questions to ask when you're doing a solidarity action. Like, you should be wondering what your role is and how to best suit it. But I was just getting high and going, oh, damn. Ah. And I also really realized that maybe me smoking weed there, some assholes walking by, they smell weed, they see this protest for Indigenous rights, and they go, ah, these stupid fucking hippies, these drug addicts, these losers. And I didn't want that to be associated with them. And so I felt fucking like horrendously guilty, and it really like I ended up getting really high because I hadn't eaten all day, and I kind of went into this like guilt trip, and I just like kind of walked around Nathan Phillips Square for a bit, just like looking at the different buildings around me and the people around me and going like, ah, fuck. Ah, what is life? What is the world? Right.
I think you touched on something important there. Doing good allyship.
Yeah. Word. That's a much more succinct way to put why I felt guilty. I wanted to make sure I was being a good ally, because it's not just about showing up. It's about what you do when you're there. Another thing that disappointed me about my own allyship was I did not talk to new people when I was there. I did chant with people. I did walk beside people. I exchanged smiles with the occasional person or something. And I did like talk briefly to the people I held hands with in the round dance. But I didn't actually go up to any indigenous people and even just like, I don't know, just engage and just say, wow, I feel honored to even be able to be here with you or something like that. Or just like, I don't know, like if you were there at that protest, you would have asked people, you would have seen someone standing there with a flag and gone, oh, yo, tell me about this flag. What does this mean or something? And like, just like engaged with people and then got in some kind of dialogue going. And I thought, damn it, these protests aren't going to mean anything if I can't fucking talk to people, because we need to be able to talk to each other. I've seen so many bullshit videos of clashes between Canadian citizens and people who are barricading a railway. And people are just talking past each other or even refusing to talk at all. And it's like, damn it. We can actually work through this issue. It's not this impassable fucking line in the sand that no one can understand. It's not that as polarizing as it needs to be. Climate change affects everyone, and most people fucking know it. And our government system's founded on injustice. I think even the assholes in the West who want to separate understand that Canada has something wrong at its core, even if they've got a weird-ass capitalist fascist way of framing it. Like, this country was established through forcefully stealing people's lands. That's not a just way to establish law. Our jurisdiction is crown lands, most of it unceded, that just through pen strokes, someone said, boom, this shit right here, it belongs to the Queen, the monarchy of Canada. Yeah, what a great way to found a goddamn country. It's there's this just rot at the core of it that is really just fucking like, obviously clear in the climate crisis too. Goddamn.
Do you think that the legal system is insufficient to solve these problems?
I think insofar as these problems are caused in the majority by wealthy corporations, and insofar as the justice system operates through money, you literally have to pay to have good legal defense. Being held up in courts for months is very expensive and very taxing, and it's a luxury only provided to those with wealth. And that alone, I think, invalidates our justice system, that how much money you have can determine the quality of the defense you receive. Your ability to sue is even it's based on that. And yeah, as we saw with SNC-Lavalin, it really is money that controls the government. It's the Corporation of Canada. It's run like a business, and businesses are run pretty shittily, especially nowadays. I don't have faith in our justice system because it's completely controlled by capital, and it was established. Like, the authority, the jurisdiction of the Dominion of Canada was set up through a genocidal act of dispossession. And it's if you found a country through violence, you cannot have justice. It's very hard to make a new justice system, I'll give you that, but the way things are can't continue.
So what do you think about reconciliation, though?
I think reconciliation is a pretty word for assimilation. I am very much for unity between settlers and Indigenous people. What I'm not for is an approach to Indigenous sovereignty that sees assimilating people into the state as its fundamental goal. Like, Glenn Coulthard wrote a really, really good critique of recognition and the politics of reconciliation called Red Skin, White Mass. It's based on a reading of Fanon. Very, very good text. But it says effectively that insofar as Canada is a settler colonial regime, it was established through colonialism. Its structures are colonial. Insofar as that is true, any attempt to do justice to Indigenous people through that apparatus is going to reproduce the colonial hierarchies and violence that founded it. It's baked into the core of it. It's like Yeah. And because of that, he argues for a politics of resurgence, like true sovereignty and self-determination, the right to self-government, not the right to just become part of a system that was imposed on you against your will. And yeah, I think reconciliation, well, there's people within it who are well-meaning. And again, I do think we need to reconcile, like, settlers and indigenous people. I don't want us to be at war with each other. And I think we can come together to found a government based on consent. Like, I think that's what I want more than anything. I want a government based on consent, not on coercion. And that's very hard to achieve, but I think it's got to be possible.
Have you personally been impacted by the, specifically the Tyendinaga blockade, which is fairly near Toronto?
Not at all. I've been affected insofar as it's given me fucking hope for life. Like, it's given me a will to live. No, like, grocery store prices haven't fucking gone up. I'm not running out of propane. Like, the impact is immensely overblown. Like, it is having, like, an economic impact, but it's not the same as the economic destruction that happens to people on reserves. Like, it's been like a week, Canada. And people are, like, basically saying, you killed my family. I'm going to freeze to death. And it's like, no, you're not. It'll be okay. I mean, trains are essential, but they're not the only thing the Canadian economy has. And that being said, I don't want to downplay their effectiveness. Clearly, we've struck a bone. But it's interesting how quickly Canadians kind of turn on it out of this weird fear that, like, they're going to be starved out. It's like, maybe if they persist for like a fucking year, yeah, then maybe. But I think it'll be like, yeah, I don't know. I haven't been affected except in honestly positive ways.
What do you think about Justin Trudeau's kind of drastically changed stance a couple of days ago?
Yo, that tone switch at that press conference where he just, like, yeah, the one where he said the barricades must come down.
Yeah.
The rule of law must be obeyed. Like, oh my goodness. It's I think it's directly responsible for the arrests at Tyendinaga that happened today.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is directly responsible for the police moving in by force. The Wet'suwet'en set conditions for talks, which is what you do when you are striking. Those conditions were the removal of the RCMP from their territory, which hasn't happened. They did put forward, like, formal paperwork to say, oh yes, the RCMP agreed to withdraw, but they would leave their trailer structures. There would still be BC police presence. Like, yeah, I find it disgusting how much lying happened. Like, in that press conference, Trudeau was like, we have our hand extended to anyone who's willing to take it. And it's like, no, that's not how strikes work. It's economic disruption. And then once conditions are met, then they will come to the table. They're not going to give up their power just because you signed some paperwork as a platitude. And to see the way the media covered it as like, oh, the RCMP have left. And then the Wet'suwet'en would say, no, they haven't. That's like, oh my God, it sucks. And I love that the Mohawks and the Wet'suwet'en met. I thought that was very interesting. Mm-hmm. I kind of wish I could have been a fly on the wall there to, like, hear what was being talked about.
I believe they weren't letting reporters in either.
Yeah, no. It was private, and honestly ceremonial.
Yeah.
Like,
well, of course, they.
I can't remember the name of this tradition, so I don't want to, like, butcher it. But the Mohawk have a thing for, like, visitors where they meet them at the edge of the woods on their territory, or even, like, the metaphorical edge of the woods, and they do things like kind of like clean their ears and, like, brush their eyes and give them water and stuff, so they're able to speak, hear, and see. And it's kind of like a thing of like, okay, you're on our territory. We want to make sure that you're, like, fully there, that, like, boom, we'll clean your ears so that you can hear what's being said. We'll clean your eyes and stuff so that you can see. We'll give you water so you can drink and, like, be able to speak. And it's, I don't know. I read about that in the ATPN article about the meeting, and I don't know. Something about it struck me.
What do you think about some of the more conservative criticism, especially coming from Andrew Scheer in the last week with...
Check your privilege.
Yeah, calling the protesters privileged, which comes from, you know, there's...
A place of privilege?
It is a luxury for some people to protest, though. Many of those people out there are not, like, either foreign-funded professional protesters with those Soros bucks. But yeah, lots of people simply can't afford to not do that. What do you think about those comments?
Canadians really do not realize how poorly they treat Indigenous people, even just in their everyday speech, which is kind of fucked. But yeah, good old Andrew Scheer. Didn't he like step down as leader? Why do we still talk to him? Like, fuck.
He's still.
Isn't he gonna get? I know he's still officially the leader, but like we're trying to find a new one. Why do we even give a shit what this guy says? He's like, oh my god, that embezzling asshole. But like, man, those comments. I hate how the right can co-opt the language of the left. Like, check your privilege being spun around to like, no, it's number one, the protesters in solidarity. Sure, some of them have privilege, but it's solidarity. Again, it's across the aisles. The actual Indigenous people where this movement started, like, they're not coming from a place of fucking privilege. It's not a privilege to be colonized. And oh my God, I also just hate how that conservative response makes it all about like me, you know what I mean? Like, oh, how dare they do economic disruption? That is not how we protest in Canada. And it's like, no, that's what a protest is. We've got this bullshit neoliberal version where we parade around with signs, but no, an honest to God strike is a strike at the economic system. That's the only way you get people to the bargaining table. But it's clear that doesn't even necessarily work. God, it seems weirdly close to like an authoritarian, just like very racial, almost fascistic rhetoric. Like, I hated the praise that Jason Kenney, who isn't Andrew Scheer, but basically they are, like Jason Kenney in Alberta, he was responding to some civilians who tore down a barricade at a rail yard. Now, it's really fucked up that both the government and the police supported the civilians taking that kind of vigilante initiative. If we really care about the rule of law, we should give a fuck about that. But clearly it doesn't matter. But seeing him praise this kind of shit and like just language like tear down, and like, I feel like I didn't give a satisfying answer to like the question of Andrew Scheer, but it almost feels like his statements feel insignificant to me in a way. I have a lot of faith in this movement, and I think the government moving in with force the way they did is only going to give people more resolve. And it's also just like people now know that this strategy is very effective and it's very easy. And that's like Hannah Arendt has an essay called On Violence, where she talks about the modern world and the switching of power from big nations to small guerrilla forces. I mean, I honestly believe a rail blockade is a nonviolent act. If it's against colonial violence like that, I think it's a nonviolent act. Or like a militant nonviolence, kind of like a Gandhian non-participation kind of thing. But yeah, the way power has changed hands in the modern age, or even the fucking digital whatever age this is exciting and terrifying.
And that will bring us to the progress report, the time I set aside to talk about what I'm learning here at OJT. On the topic of learning, I'm now back for the final semester of J school, and things look a bit different. By the time this is released, the first-year students will finally be in the newsroom using the desks and computers. They've been entirely virtual before this, so getting to know them is exciting. There's about twice as many of them as there was of us last year, so there's some timeshare planning with COVID. Learning from and hanging out with the more experienced students was one of the best parts of being a rookie, so I'm glad we'll finally have some of that, whatever form it takes. Beyond that, we're now at the stage where everything is hands-on, practical work. There's no more class time, just pitch meetings. For me at least, the sense of direction is a bit different as well. Everything in this program has been geared towards developing employable skills, and now it's time to look for places to employ them. I'm back at The Guardian for my internship, but I'm also looking at plans B through who knows what. While our program involves basically no direct communications training, it is a certificate in journalism and communications. So I'm starting to keep an eye on listings for, you know, nonprofits, things like that. Now that I've got a pretty good feel for writing and interviewing, I'm focusing on professional advice when I go in to talk with my instructors. One thing I need help with is time management. Without burning myself out entirely, I've been trying to work something close to what a professional might do each week. The Guardian sends out an email listing what each reporter is working on, so I'm going from that. I know much of it comes with practice, but I'm trying to get advice on, you know, how to plan things, what to prioritize, and where to draw the line. This year, I finally learned the meaning of good enough when it comes to writing. Nothing is ever perfect with writing or anything else creative, and with a deadline and an audience, good enough just has to be good enough. Now I just need to figure out how many is enough and in what order. There's a lot of freedom to plan as I like each day, at least as a student. I'm not a procrastinator, but I will spend time poorly and find the clock has spun with nothing to show, or too much of something that wasn't a priority. Then there's the little things, like organizing files or best practices for backing up records for legal protection. I've only got a few more months of direct access to these instructors, and they are an excellent resource. I don't want to leave thinking I left anything on the table, or in the bottom of a desk drawer. And that will do it for this week's OJT. You can follow Daniel Platts and his band, Discontinuity, on Instagram at dis.continuity, and you can like their page on Facebook. Their EP, Disc 1, is available on everything from Spotify to Napster. Daniel is on Twitter at Hegelian Outhouse under the name Drop Top Romanov. You can follow this podcast on Instagram at OJT_podcast and on Twitter at OJTpodcast. The Facebook page is OJT On The Job Training. You can follow me on Instagram at logan.mclean.75 and on Twitter at loganmclean94. And finally, listeners, please check out my website, ojtpod.ca, for written stories and photography. The podcast is available there and on all major streaming platforms. Please rate and subscribe and leave a review. Everything helps when getting a podcast off the ground. And if you like this show and want more interesting guests, listener feedback is the best way to help me reach new people and make that happen. This has been OJT, On The Job Training. I'm Logan McLean. Thank you for listening.